Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Regardless of who wins the presidential election on November 8th, there's a lot of soul-searching already going on. Republicans are asking themselves, what is the GOP in the age of Trumpism? But leading Democrats are also asking themselves a similar question, especially given the white working-class voters who've moved so strongly towards Donald Trump. David Shribman puts the question simply. Have the Democrats replaced the Republicans as the party of the social, cultural, and economic elite? Shribman is executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He recently wrote in the Boston Globe about major changes in the Democratic Party, and he joins us now from Pittsburgh. David Shribman, great to have you back on the show.
Nice to talk to you also.
So first of all, let's start off with the example that you lead with in your Globe article about looking at West Virginia and how that's changed for the Democrats in the past several election cycles. How has it changed?
Well, gosh, West Virginia was so dependably Democratic that our own governor, Michael Dukakis, won it by a substantial and very easy margin in 1988. And then you go back to the next Massachusetts governor to run for president, Mitt Romney, and he won it even easier, and he was a Republican. He won, in fact, every one of the 55 counties in West Virginia. So you had a swing from one Massachusetts governor in 88 to the next one in 2012, a huge swing. And now it is West Virginia is so desperately eager to be in the Republican camp that Hillary Clinton won't make any stops there, none.
And so therein lies the question. Like, what has driven that swing? Is it Republicans embracing the concerns and needs of those working class voters, or is it Democrats abandoning them?
Well, there are two things going on. One is peculiar to West Virginia, and that's guns and coal. There are no guns. There's no coal, for example, in Massachusetts. Not a factor there. But the war on coal, as they put it there, is Democrats searching for environmental solutions to the energy crisis, and they have basically left coal in West Virginia behind. So that's a West Virginia peculiarity. But West Virginia is not the only place where this is happening. It's just a particularly good one for us because of the Massachusetts governors. The fact is that some places with heavy amounts of blue-collar voters are going to vote for Trump, and those are the people that Franklin Roosevelt brought into the party in 1932, introduced them to the party in 32, and they were sealed by 36. And now we're seeing them kind of flitting in a different direction. We've seen a little bit of that in the past, in 1980, with those Reagan Democrats. But this is a mass movement that should be very troubling to the Democrats as they begin to think about their identity post-election.
Well, I mean, as you write in your Globe piece, this group of voters, this constituency, as you just mentioned, for generations has been part of the core identity of the party. So what are the Democrats if they are not the party of working class Americans?
Well, the Democrats are the party of women who have jobs and professions. They're the party of professionals on the two coasts and of university liberals and of minorities. And that's not the party that Franklin Roosevelt put together. Of course, he did have his brain trust, and it was Harvard-oriented. But basically, the kind of people whom we described as the elite of the 50s and 60s were Republicans. This is a different era with a different kind of elite, and the elites now are in the Democratic Party.
Huh. David Shribman, let's talk about whether or not all Democrats see this as a problem, because you talked to so many people that you quoted in your Boston Globe article, and the variety of opinion is quite striking. I feel like there are a lot of Democrats who say, that's just fine with us if we lose white working class voters.
Yes, a lot of Democrats and a lot of important Democrats feel that way. One of them is James Carville, whom you remember, the raging Cajun from Louisiana, who was basically the brain trust behind the Clinton ascendancy in 1992. His argument is this: we traded West Virginia for New Jersey, and that's a good choice. That's a good trade. That's kind of like what the Yankees did in getting Babe Ruth in 1918. That's a good trade. A lot of Democrats feel that way. A lot of Democratic moderates feel that way, not only liberals. And so there's a tension here. The labor movement is apoplectic about this. They feel comfortable in the Democratic, labor leaders feel comfortable in the Democratic coalition, and they worry about how many of their folks are drifting into the Trump camp.
Huh. Now, it's interesting because, so you mentioned James Carville. You also had this, what I thought was a rather stunning quote from Will Marshall. He's president and founder of the Progressive Policy Institute, was very close to the Clintons as well. And he says that he told you that the party's emphasis should be on college education, suburban moderates. And he kind of looked at it from an electoral or political perspective rather than one of governing and policy, because the quote that you have is Will Marshall saying that the swing voters who hold the balance of power in key battleground states aren't particularly angry and don't see the economy as rigged against them. They give priority to growth over fairness and are more inclined to help U.S. businesses succeed than to punish them. Now,
if you take that phrase, preference for growth over fairness.
Yes, that's the one that really caught my attention.
Doesn't that really describe the Republicans of another era?
I was wondering, which Democrat is this exactly?
That's right. I mean, that describes precisely the Reagan outlook, don't you think?
I do. And so let me ask you, if we have, you know, a Democratic insider like Marshall saying we should go for exactly these voters who look for growth over fairness, and the subtext there is these are the voters who have benefited from the growth, so maybe yes, they're not so worried about fairness. I mean, does that really mean that this is the wing of the Democratic Party, despite the strength of the Sanders campaign, despite the popularity of Elizabeth Warren, despite that opposite wing, that the Will Marshalls of the world say, don't worry about it. We got to stick with the power elite.
Well, a lot of them are saying that, and that really does trouble the people you mentioned earlier, of course, Senator Sanders, Senator Warren. It troubles them, and it really is at odds with the history, or at least the contemporary history of the Democratic Party. Now, think back, really, about who the Republicans used to be. The Republicans used to be the party of liberation. They were the party of industrialization. Now they're the party, not so much, right?
Hmm. Well, so let's talk about the other wing, because I'm calling them wings. I mean, I'm sure it's more like a hodgepodge. But because, you know, you did talk to people who said, okay, well, you could focus on the coastal educated elite, or you could also take a look at, the energy that drove Bernie Sanders' campaigns. You could take a look at millennials and the fact that they are very much interested in fairness. You could take a look at those people who support Elizabeth Warren. You could take a look at working class voters, both white and minority voters, who still stick with the Democratic Party. You know, how is the party going to reflect their interests if they're going to make a lasting coalition?
Well, that's why they're going to have, no matter what happens in this election, but presume for a second that Secretary Clinton wins this election. They're going to have a huge question about what kind of president she's going to be. Is she going to be the president of Wall Street and Goldman Sachs? Is she going to be the president of the AFL-CIO and of Elizabeth Warren? Is she going to be the president of Will Marshall? What is she going to be? Of course, we've only had 44 presidents, and they're all different. And she'll, of course, have her own agenda and her own identity, because she has her own identity and her own character now. But there's going to be a huge fight within this party about who they are in the future. Mrs. Clinton will have a huge voice in that if she wins. But still, there are a lot of people on the two wings, as you put it, who are going to have something to say about it, and particularly since a lot of those people are very, very young and they're the future of the party.
So can you have, I mean, you quoted William Daley, right? Son of former Chicago Mayor Daley.
He's the son of a mayor and the brother of a mayor.
And the brother of a mayor, right. And he told you that we have even more left, an even more left Democratic Party, more diverse, watching government in action after so much inaction. And I'm wondering, In the long run, are these two impulses competing within the Democratic Party? Can they coexist? Can you have the economically progressive party of Bernie Sanders, you know, live alongside the concentration or of the power elite that Will Marshall is looking after? Or ultimately, is there going to be a split there?
Well, sure you can. Think back into the Roosevelt years when you had Northeastern and urban liberals, coexisting in a party, not easily, but coexisting nonetheless in a party with Southern segregationists. And we all grew up with that party. That party was the party that Lyndon Johnson tried to bring to heel. He had to get the votes of Republicans to get that civil rights bill in 64 and the voting rights bill in 65, because the rump of his party that was situated in his own region, the South, was simply not going to go along with the civil rights bill. So you've had those kind of tensions in the Democratic Party before. They were different tensions, to be sure, but the party is, you know, big parties have big dissensions. Little parties have a lot of unity, but no power.
Hmm. You know, you quote Todd Gitlin, a Columbia University sociologist, who told you that he was startled by the fact that the Democrats are hardly competing for the people that Donald Trump is claiming. And then to swing back to a former Massachusetts governor that you talked about earlier, Michael Dukakis, he told you that, quote, we have badly neglected the work we should have been doing for blue-collar working folks. These are our people, and they have no business voting for a Republican, but you've got to take care of people and pay attention to them. I mean, I'm just wondering, is the Democratic Party now moving in a direction where Michael Dukakis' view is no longer going to hold that much sway? Is the party basically saying we can live without white working class voters?
Well, what's interesting about those two quotes, which appeared in different parts of that piece, is that Michael Dukakis is basically the personification of the mainstream Democratic Party of the late 20th century. You think of him as a student body president, right? You can imagine him at Brookline High School as the president of his class. Todd Gitlin was the second president of the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, the most radical student group of that same period or slightly later. And you have guys like that who have little in common in their background expressing the same concern. Meanwhile, you've got Will Marshall saying something completely different. It is a recipe for a huge fight.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, I mean, you've been following elections for a long, long time. I'm just wondering, was this sort of reckoning for the Democrats? It seems like it was a long time coming, and we're seeing it erupt now, but the pieces have been laid for some time.
Oh, I think so. I remember as a young person looking at the reading about the people who went to McGovern's convention in 1972 and the number of PhDs who were there, the percentage of PhDs, and it was astonishing. And so for the party has been moving toward a party of PhDs, university professionals, university liberals, and, of course, the ascension of active women in politics who have really drifted into the Democratic Party or found voice in the Democratic Party have really reinforced that impulse. I think you're right. It's been a long time coming.
Now, what does this reckoning mean that it's happening amongst the Democrats? At the same time, there's that parallel reckoning going on with the GOP.
Well, I'll tell you who this is really good for. It's really good for the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, because they love to have conferences about the future of the party and what went wrong. And so a lot of people are wringing their hands, but I bet you people on JFK Boulevard in Cambridge are really happy about this, because there are two great conferences almost certainly being drafted right now.
And I'm sure all those white working class voters are saying, yeah, exactly what we need, more white papers and more conferences.
From the Kennedy School at Harvard.
Exactly. Well, David Shrivman is executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning former politics correspondent for the Boston Globe. His recent op-ed in the Globe was titled Democrats, the Party of the Professional Class. We've got a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. David Shrivman, it is always so great to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks so much for inviting me. I look forward to doing it again.
And listeners, we want to remind you that WBUR will be broadcasting the final presidential debate tonight at 9 o'clock. And while you listen, you can visit WBUR.org for a live fact check of the candidates' claims, powered by NPR reporters and editors. That's at WBUR.org starting at 9 o'clock tonight. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.